Hello and welcome to our next episode in the Dive and Dig News podcast, where we bring you the latest in the field of maritime archaeology. I'm Dr. Lucy Blue and I represent the Honor Frost Foundation that supports maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. This week, my colleague Kathy Giograndi interviews Dr. Nicholas Fleming about his recent book, Apollonia on My Mind, the memoir of a paraplegic ocean scientist. I was lucky enough to work with Nick many years ago and thus have some insight into his amazing life. So hold on to your seats as Nick takes you under the ocean on his time machine, covering over 60 years of exploration and discovery to learn about man's relationship with the ocean.
I've tried to study the way in which people react to the sea, what they do with the sea, through time, both past and future. And I sort of need not spaceships, but at least time machines to go back to look at the way people were living in the past by the sea. We need archaeology, and to look into the future, what will happen to the human race as the climate changes and so on, we need computer modelling. So although they sound like very different subjects, one sort of cultural and backward looking and one high tech and forward looking, they actually join together and interact very positively.
The title of your book includes the name Apollonia. Where is it? What is it? And why did you go there?
It's near Benghazi in Libya, about 200 kilometers to the east of Benghazi towards the Egyptian border. It was founded by the Greeks in about 650 BC, and they built a very substantial harbour around a group of islands. It was a massive engineering feat. They hollowed out the islands, used the rock to build breakwaters, and built slipways for their ships. And I then heard about it when I was an undergrad, in fact, before I went to university, in the summer of 1957. And as I'd been trained as a diver already, I thought it would be very interesting to try and make a map of this underwater city. And with some friends at Cambridge, we put together a package involving architecture, modern survey instruments, and the technology that I'd learnt in the Marines to make a map of this huge Greek city underwater.
You went there when? When did you go there? And how has it changed since then? Have you been back?
Well, it was the summer of 1958. I know these numbers sound very strange. People may think I'm in 68 or 78, but I don't. It was 1958. And it was a group of undergraduates. We were there for a month. And we used snorkeling and scuba gear to map it. And it's still the most complete map of that underwater city. It's never been superseded. I took the family there in 2003 to have a look at it. And the Libyan authorities were so hospitable. It was absolutely wonderful. There'd been actually a lot of damage, quite extraordinary changes. Huge rock walls. I mean, I don't mean walls built out of stones. I mean residual walls that have been left in position on the edges of the islands to protect them from waves. These had been broken through, and there was a lot of sand and wave action going into the city. So I'm really very worried that it's decaying quite rapidly now, and as soon as possible, I think a modern survey team should go out there and redo all the work to modern standards.
Following that project, you went on to explore hundreds of more submerged sites, including two that we've worked on together, Pavlo Petri and a Neolithic site in the northern Sporides called Ios Petros. Tell me what we learned from these and what can we learn?
Well, of course, the two sites you picked are very interesting because Pavlo Petri is Bronze Age, about 3,000 to 5,000 years old, and Ios Petros is Neolithic, about 7,000 years old. When I started this work in the around 1960, I'd realized from Apollonia that you could measure the change of sea level locally. I went to the National Institute of Oceanography to ask why it had changed, and I got the absolutely classic answer. It's two things and a bit of both. One is the global sea level change due to climate, ice volumes and so on, the same thing that we're worrying about now with global warming, and the other is local earthquakes or tectonics. So, okay, I'd got the change of sea level at Apollonia, which is almost 3 metres, but I didn't know how much of it was either due to climate change or earthquakes. So I thought if I measure a few other sites and find out the statistics of what's happening, I can separate these two factors. I started making lists of sites around the Mediterranean coast and found that there were over 1,000 Greek and Roman ports. So the statistics got very interesting indeed. And over the next 20 years, I visited one country after another, either with snorkeling equipment or scuba or both, or sometimes with echo sounders, mapping and measuring the change of level at hundreds of sites, and published a series of papers in geological journals. I turned the observations into a local sea level change and then put it into a lot of complicated equations to separate out earth movements and climate change. And that's been a very productive technology. A bit, as I was saying at the beginning, two time machines. The past data enabled us to calibrate models which will predict the future.
Last year was the start of the UN Decade for Ocean Science and for Sustainable Development. The oceans are so important to us, but yet they're dying. I mean, what's your thoughts on this?
We are messing up the ocean, to use a scientific term. We really are messing it up. And the television environmental programs are raising all the right issues. Plastic nanoparticles, larger plastics, chemicals dissolving in the ocean, radioactive materials, stirring up mud and sediments from industrial activities. The real physics of what's happening, the solution of carbon dioxide in the ocean, the problem with coral reefs and so on, it's absolutely colossal. There are all sorts of expert groups working on this, and I was involved in the UNESCO committees in the 1980s when we could see all this coming. If you look at the reports of scientific committees and the first committee on climate change in 1989 and 1990, the forecasts they were making were extremely, I wouldn't say accurate, but they picked all the key issues. And it was the resistance of industry and some governments obviously wanting to protect their industries, which delayed action for several decades. If the human race had reacted in the right sort of intellectual and emotional way in 1990, we'd have been 20 years better off in understanding what was happening in the ocean and controlling climate change. So we've got ourselves into an incredibly difficult situation. And there's been a UN report just in the last few days about increasing temperature, making many parts of the world very difficult to live in.
Is there hope still? Are we going to be able to clean that ocean up? And
where there's life, there's hope.
Yes.
But that's not a very hopeful remark.
No.
If there'd been nothing happening in Ukraine and all the major countries were working together, and there's a lot of good scientists in Russia, if we'd all been working together and the UN report had just come out pointing out how disastrous the track is that we're on at the moment, there would have been a lot of hope. The present situation means that the collaboration between major powers is completely smashed. It's not just that Russia isn't collaborating on a scheme, but of course, Western countries and the USA, Japan, and even China are completely sort of thrown off balance by the response of what they have to do. No matter how the Ukrainian disaster actually ends, it's going to take 10 years for the dust to settle and all the refugees and all the destruction of people's lives and property and so on, so that the proper response to the climate change report is going to be pushed right to the back, which is going to make the disaster even worse. It's very worrying.
Very, very. Nick, your memoir, the subtitle, I should say, of your book is Memoir of a Paraplegic Ocean Scientist. What happened and how has that affected your research?
I'd been working in Turkey in 1969 along the southwest coast, mapping this amazing underwater cities there. I do recommend it. But on the way back from Turkey, I was driving through Yugoslavia and my diving van was hit on the side by a dangerous driver trying to overtake. He realized he was driving straight into a heavy truck coming straight at him. So he swung the wheel over, hit the side of my vehicle, and I rolled down the mountainside and broke my back.
Gosh, wow. But you have lived through so much. And I remember when we went to Ayios Petros, you were able to stay on an uninhabited island for several weeks and cope with, I mean, not easy conditions. We had no running water. I mean, Nick, you have managed to do so much. So what do you say about disability? Is it something?
Well, I have devoted a whole chapter to this in my book, in the Apollonia on My Mind. I've packed all the stuff about disability into one chapter and ignored it in the other 10 chapters. And the chapter that I've put in my book is entitled A Statistical Sample of One.
Right.
And I've deliberately decided simply to describe the facts of what happened to me, one person. Not because I'm egotistical about it, but because I cannot, as a scientist, extrapolate from one.
Right. No, no, absolutely
to hundreds
not.
Of thousands of other people. And I cannot preach to them. I cannot advise. I cannot tell them what to do. What I hope is that people will read that chapter and simply take away what they want. There are a lot of clues and sort of little hints about the way to do things, as you say, on an uninhabited island, how to get into a submarine, how to get into a helicopter.
Fantastic, because you have done it. You have really made the best of your situation. I can vouch
for that. And, of course,
scuba
diving. I forgot to mention that.
Yes, of course, yes.
When I was in hospital at Stoke Mandeville, where the wonderful doctors put me together again. And I asked a friend to bring in an aqualung and some weights, and well, not fins, obviously, but mask and stuff. And with my wonderful physiotherapist, I taught myself to dive again in the swimming pool at Stoke Mandeville.
Amazing, amazing. Nick, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you about your really fantastic book, and I'm so moved to be here. Thank you, Nick.
Let's go and warm the pie up.
Okay, sounds good.
What an incredible life. This interview really reveals what a massive contribution Nick has made over decades, bringing together different research disciplines and helping us to advance our knowledge of the world's seas and oceans. A true pioneer in ocean science, and his book, Apollonia on My Mind, is a must-read for all those keen to learn more about the development of maritime archaeology and ocean exploration. I hope you've enjoyed this Dive and Dig news podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation. Thanks for listening, and I hope you will join us again soon.